You are listening to the Down the Wormhole podcast, exploring the strange and fascinating relationship between science and religion. This week, our hosts are...
My name is Ian Benz, Associate Professor of Elementary Science Education at UNC Charlotte. And a food combination that I don't get why people like is when they put French fries on top of pizza.
Rachel Jackson, Rabbi at Agudas Israel in Hendersonville, North Carolina. And the food combination I don't understand is using mayonnaise as a dipping sauce.
I'm Zach Jackson, UCC pastor in Reading, Pennsylvania, and this one's gonna garner me some enemies, but I'm not a huge fan of chocolate and peanut butter.
That's blasphemy right there.
Get out.
Just stop talking.
Get out.
But I'm tendering my resignation from the podcast right now, I guess.
Not allowed.
My name is Adam Pryor. I teach at Bethany College in Lenzburg, Kansas. 2 weeks in a row, I've remembered to say my name. And the food combination that I actually don't particularly care for is butter on bread.
What? Whoa. Another controversial one.
I don't know.
All bread or just untoasted bread?
Nope, pretty much all bread. I like my bread unadulterated.
Kendra Holtmore. And I don't get ketchup on pancakes, which, to be fair, might just be something that my weird sister does.
What?
What? Why would anyone?
She may be the only person in the world who gets that combination, other than toddlers.
But I still don't like it.
Ketchup on pancakes?
That's just wrong.
Does she fold it with the ketchup in it, or does she cut it?
Is it like butter?
Dipped it.
Or syrup?
It's a dip thing.
That's so weird.
It's a dip thing.
Sorry, Kendra.
Okay.
So I ask this question today about unusual combinations of food, because we are talking about a very common combination that also makes me a little bit sick, and that being religion and politics. And specifically, the separation of church and state, which I know if you're thinking at home, like, isn't this episode number 9? And y'all are already jumping into something as controversial as church and state. And the answer is yes. Yes, we are, because the professors among us have tenure and the rest of us don't care. So here we are.
Because we have built up trust and we're not afraid.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. We've built up trust. We're not afraid. We hopefully have... we want to model constructive conversations, and that's one of our main goals of this podcast. And so if we're going to model constructive conversations, we should start with one that has been neither constructive nor really a conversation. They've been mostly two-way monologues between angry people. And even the when we're thinking about a whole host of these issues, they keep coming back to the connection of religion and politics. You can't escape that in the United States, and it's just the way it is. And so in order to even talk about any of the topics we want to get to next, we have to cross this bridge. So before we talk about specific instances of where religion and politics have gotten all muddled together, like ketchup and pancakes, we need to talk a little bit about the history of this odd couple. And so as I'm doing research into this, it keeps going back, and it keeps going back. And in order to understand this, we have to understand that. In order to understand this, we have to understand that. And I'm not going to do a kind of hardcore history podcast where I talk for 6 hours about all of the unfolding histories that led us up to the modern day, because that works for him, but not for us. And you all are not that patient to sit here until tonight.
So Zach, are you going to start in your favorite century, or are you going to go a little bit before that in England, late 17th century? Or are you going to go straight towards your 18th century crush?
Psh. Oh, Thomas Rachel, Paine. We are going back to the 5th century. So buckle up. Yeah, that's right. Now,
strap in, people.
I have to say at the beginning here, the United States is a diverse place. We have a lot of religions and people groups. We are a melting pot of society, of cultures. But the founders of this country, the people who wrote these laws and the Constitution, all that, were primarily of European descent, primarily, overwhelmingly Christian, at least in heritage. And so they brought to this certain assumptions, presuppositions that made its way into the framework of America. So I'm going to preface it that way because that's what I'm going to focus on. And it's not because I don't think there is value in talking about Confucius or Muhammad or indigenous religions and governments and all of that. I think there's so much to be learned from that. But if we're going to talk about clashes between religion and state in America, we have to go and look at Western European Christian history. Mm-hmm. And I apologize for that because it's not a very flattering history. And it's also historically been just way overemphasized. But here we are.
Emphasizing it again.
You get to have a straight white Christian male explain church history to you again, because we haven't done that enough. But we're going to go super fast, like 30,000 feet, look out your window on the left and see the Grand Canyon Pass, sort of an overview, despite the fact that we're starting in the 5th century. Please, yeah. Interrupt. Go ahead.
I think it would be good, obviously letting listeners know that in our show notes, obviously, we'll have links to resources to kind of, if you want to delve further into the history of the separation of church, state, and establishment clause.
Oh, yeah. Oh, and we're going to get deep into the establishment clause, probably ending up in the next episode. Maybe in this episode. We'll find out. You listener at home, you'll know the answer before I do. So, for the first couple hundred years of the Christian church, it was a somewhat underground movement. We were certainly not as persecuted as people would want you to believe. We really love this narrative that Christians from day one were being hunted and slaughtered, and that's not entirely true. Romans were actually pretty tolerant of other religions as long as they played nicely. Mm-hmm. And the problem with Christians,
as long as they paid their taxes.
Yeah, Christians didn't want to play nicely, mm-hmm. or pay their taxes. Specifically, the tax to Caesar, because a part of that was you had exactly. to declare Caesar as Lord, which yep. was a problem because the early Christians were fond of saying Christ is Lord. And they were very anti-establishment and made a show of the fact that they wouldn't pay that tax. And mm-hmm. the Romans, they broke the law, so the Romans... Mm-hmm. charge them under the law. And there were a couple of scattered serious persecutions under Nero and Domitian and some others. But for the most part, it was just our own instigation. And that's fine. Jesus was an anti-establishment revolutionary as well. So these things happen. until Constantine famously saw the sign of the cross or the Cairo symbol and heard the voice of the pacifist rabbi say, in this conquer, right? Because why wouldn't he? And so he did, and he converted to Christianity, and then the church could come out of hiding, and it became much more of a legitimate religion, though not the official religion yet. But in the early 5th century, there was a whole bunch of issues as the Roman Empire was starting to fall apart. And so the capital of the Western Roman Empire moved out of Rome. They were in Ravenna. And so Rome itself was left to its own devices. And so the Roman bishop, which we know now as the Pope, kind of took over administrative duties because they were already taking offering and tithe and whatnot. So why not also take taxes and help with utilities and things like that? And so Pope Leo, who had a famous confrontation with Attila the Hun and, according to legend, convinced him not to sack Rome, which probably there were other issues involved, and it wasn't just because he was such a great negotiator, but it set a precedent for the Pope to get involved in political matters, international political matters. And after Pope Leo was Pope Hilarius, who is the life of the party. And after Pope Hilarius was Pope Simplicius, who was not what his name suggests. He was not a simple man.
Nor was Hilarius really that funny.
I mean, we don't have any written history of his joke book, but who knows? Lost to history. Maybe we'll find that somewhere.
He's not smiling in his saint picture.
I mean, if you had to sit still for a week to have somebody paint you, you wouldn't be smiling either.
I don't know. If I was Hilarius, I might.
Yeah, I like that.
Anyway, so we go from funny and simple.
But Pope Simple, who's not really simple, was the Pope when Rome fell, which was because the Roman general Odoacer, who was not paid and who was a Visigoth, he's some kind of Goth. He was really into My Chemical Romance and had black straight
the
hair
original and, the original emo.
Yeah, he was this emo general from the north, and he sacked Rome, and when he did, he walked in and saw Pope Simplicius, who was doing his thing, and the people really liked the Pope, and he was running a pretty tight ship. And so he said he wanted to get as much of the people on board as possible. So he said, yeah, no, you're in charge now. You're officially in charge. I'll acknowledge you as being in charge of Rome. And then from that point on, we kind of had the Pope being a strong political force. After him, Pope Felix III, who I don't really have much to say about other than the fact that he looks like a wonderful combination of Lady Elaine Fairchild from Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood and an elf on the shelf. And I'll leave a picture in the show notes because it's wonderfully uncanny. But from that point on, Western Europe was defined by the synergy of religious and political leaders. You couldn't do, one of them couldn't move without the other one acting. And so you had this line of popes that were all just like someone's nephew and someone's cousin and someone's son who had no business being the Pope whatsoever. I mean, there's stories of popes with like having orgies and just not really the sorts of things that you want to have the leader of the church involved in. And at the same time, you couldn't have an emperor or a king without being acknowledged by the Pope. And so there's all this back and forth, and it's just the whole thing. So after a while of just festering in this weird political-religious relationship in Western Europe, sometime in the 1500s, this plucky band of Catholics decided that they'd like to reform things and that we as a church have lost our way. And, you know, the Catholic Church was basically selling get-out-of-hell-free cards, or get-out-of-purgatory-free cards, if you paid a bunch of money, because they had all of these expensive wars they had to pay for. And so they were selling off indulgences, what we call them. And so there were these Protestant leaders. We call them Protestants now. Literally, they were protesters, like Luther and Calvin and Zwingli and a bunch of others, that across Western Europe and England, they decided we need to either reform this or we're going to take our ball and go home. And so the Catholic Church at the time said, no, you don't have authority. I'm the Pope. I decide what we're going to do. And so they said, all right, well, we're going to start our own club. And so they did. And what that led to was a lot of dead people. So there was the Knights Revolt, the German Peasant War, which killed 100,000 people at least. And then the 30 Years' War, which lasted for upwards of three decades. And a third of all Germans died during that war. And that was just Catholics and Protestants. Now, they were united by their religion, but it was also a political issue, that it was not just like you go through the same town and all the Catholics are over here and all the Protestants are over here. It's like this town is a Protestant town. This town is a Catholic town. This area is a Catholic area. And so it was not just about religious. It was about this unfortunate mixture of religion and government. And it was during that time that enormous amounts of landless refugees who had lost everything that they had in the war fled to Great Britain. And then Britain was overwhelmed, and so they sent everyone to the colonies, and you have Pennsylvania. Pennsylvania was filled with German refugees who came here. They just spoke German. I mean, this is why in my area we have, all right, so from where I'm sitting right now in my church, there is a half a mile behind me a German Reformed church, which is now UCC, and a half a mile in front of me is a German Reformed church, which is now UCC, and I am sitting in a German Reformed church, which is now UCC. So that is pretty common. And then if you take the Lutherans, a half a mile that way to my left is a Lutheran church, and then a half a mile in front of me is another Lutheran church, and then a half a mile behind me is another Lutheran church. So there were a lot of Germans who were coming out of this war-torn area and trying to make a home here in Pennsylvania, including also my family, the Moors, came over here for that same reason. And so at the end of this war, the Peace of Westphalia officially recognized Lutherans and Calvinists as separate official branches of Western Christianity, but only in name. People were still getting persecuted and still getting killed, and you still had the British Civil Wars, the Swiss Civil Wars, and in that British back and forth after, King Henry VIII wanted to get divorced and the Pope wouldn't let him, and so he said, all right, well, everyone else is making their own church, so I'm going to make my own church here in England. And they had the Church of England, and there was Catholics were kicked out, and then Queen Mary wanted to be Catholic again, and then so kicked all the Protestants out, and then Elizabeth, after her, brought them all back, and it was just this whole back and forth, and everyone in and out, and in and out, and people are getting killed, and my ancestors, the Jacksons, Robert Jackson, fled and came here to New York, and they moved to New Jersey, and there's been a Jackson there ever since. And in Connecticut and Massachusetts, which is where the Congregationalists settled. The Congregationalists were the people who said, the only people who can tell the individual church what to do is the individual church. These are the pilgrims and whatnot. They were fiercely congregational. They said, government can't tell us what to do. The church down the street can't tell us what to do, because they came out of this war-torn place where the government kept telling them what to do and how to worship and where they're and how to die sometimes. So in the early days of Connecticut and Massachusetts, a part of your tax dollars went to paying for the local clergy in the local church, whether or not you were a member, which you definitely were, because you had to be. You had to be a Congregationalist to have citizenship there. If you were a Baptist, you were kicked out. If you were Catholic, you were kicked out. If you were a Quaker, you were kicked out. They had some leniency for Jewish people, but only some, depending on the person and how useful they were to the local community.
Tolerant to a short extent.
Tolerant as long as it benefited them. But if you came back, if you were a Baptist and you were kicked out and then you came back, they'd kill you. And this is pretty common practice. In Maryland was started as a haven for Catholics that weren't allowed in other places. And then it wasn't. And then it was. And then it wasn't. And then it was. And it was this big kerfuffle about, we had religious freedom in these colonies as long as you were the right religion. But if you were the wrong religion, then you didn't have religious freedom, which, you know, is not actually religious freedom. But if you're in the majority, it sure seems like it. It's religious freedom for us.
For me. Yep.
Right. For me and my people that didn't have religious freedom back in the mother country. And so that's the backdrop for the First Amendment and the Establishment Clause. The founders were creating this country, and they were pretty much across the board Christians of some bent. even in just in name. Some of them were deists, which means they believe in a god, but not a personal god, and a god that created the universe, set it in motion, made the laws, and then just walked away and is getting lunch somewhere, I guess. That's the clockmaker god.
The clockmaker theology.
Right. Some were a lot of them were Quakers. Some of them were like, kind of Quakers. Quakers more in community than in any belief system. And they're just kind of pretty open about some great divine power out there that we're not going to name and not going to do anything about.
You're saying is that they were just like us.
They were super diverse. There wasn't really anyone who out and out admitted that they didn't believe in God, because you couldn't, because, you know, right. My boy T-Pain did, and he died friendless and penniless. If you
Can
write,
I just say that I love yeah. you call him that.
T-Pain.
Yeah, it establishes like a solid connection between the two of you.
Well, a romance.
A bromance.
I feel that way
Thomas
about
Paine.
Thomas Jefferson. I got to be honest. Because even though he did a lot of bad things, I still like Thomas Jefferson. Well,
Thomas Paine and I have both lived in Bordentown. We are both writers, and we both have big noses, and so that's our connection.
Okay, so you were talking about the
yes.
The founders and the First Amendment, which
right.
the first 10 amendments eventually became the Bill of Rights, but I think we need to clarify what the Establishment Clause is and does.
Yeah, exactly. So it was, thank you for bringing me back. This is the backdrop. They were all some flavor of Western European Christian, and all of them had in their living memory this bloodshed that had happened since the Reformation, and in many cases before then. They're still remembering the Crusades and all the persecutions and all of the heretics that got burned in the past couple thousand years. And they're tired of that. And they don't want to make the same mistakes on this side of the world. If they can help it, and they've seen what happens when Christianity gets muddled up in the power of government, that it corrupts both, that they were going to separate that in some way, shape, or form. Because people will die for their religion and they'll kill for their governments. And so if you combine the two, you end up with this bloody massacre. So the phrase separation of church and state is not in the Constitution, not in the Bill of Rights, it's not in any official document. It comes originally from a letter that Thomas Jefferson wrote to a group of Baptists, assuring them that the government wasn't going to interfere with what they were doing. That's the first place it appears in writing. It's in the background of everything. Madison and Monroe picked up on it later. John Adams, at one point, when assuring people that we were not going to go to war with Muslims, said that we are in no way, shape, or form a Christian nation. We are not founded on Christian principles. We are not a Christian nation. And so the wars between Christians and Muslims have no bearing on us. But yet, all of that being said, we are still a nation that were founded by people who were Christians. And we are now a nation being run by people who also have religious beliefs. And you cannot fully separate the two, because a deeply held religious belief will color all of your decision making. And what is government except for decision making in practice? And so people will always bring their religious convictions to the table. The problem is, how do we separate the two when your religious freedom infringes on another person's religious freedom?
Right.
Which brings us to the messy place where we are right now.
I, I think I would highlight that I really like Zach's description, if for no other reason than it fits really nicely with like the concurring opinions from Everson versus Board of Education in 46-47, which is like the big, like sort of contemporary case, right? So when Justice Black is writing in favor of the court's opinion here, which was that you can't use buses in order to get children to Catholic schools, basically, right? He's describing the history of what goes on. And I love this line that he wrote, right? So with the power of government supporting them at various times and places, Catholics had persecuted Protestants. Protestants had persecuted Catholics. Protestant sects had persecuted other Protestant sects. Catholics of one shade of belief had persecuted Catholics of another shade of belief. And all these had from time to time persecuted Jews.
He's not wrong.
Hey, there's common ground.
It sort of sets the stage pretty clearly, I think.
Yeah, that was just to clarify, that was the Everson versus Board of Education 1947.
Yes. I was going to ask if you could explain for those of us who are not down with constitutional law, what was the background of that?
Yeah. So this is Everson versus Board of Education, 1947, which is probably the first modern case that's brought forward about separation of church and state in terms of particularly like public education. And it had to do with whether or not you could use school buses to get kids to Catholic schools instead of just public schools, and whether that was actually an undue burden on taxpayers who did not affirm Catholicism. Right. So this becomes a sort of piece. But in describing, in writing the concurring opinion for the court, Justice Black uses this as a description of what that First Amendment, which is then extended to the states through the 14th Amendment, is really set up to do.
Go ahead.
No. And I was going to say, right, like, I think we sort of forget, like, it was pretty rough and tumble when things got started here. We love the Puritans, but man, oh man, did they know how to make sure that you agreed with them.
So going back to the court case, one of the lines that I appreciated in the court case says this: the establishment of religion clause of the First Amendment means this. Neither a state nor a federal government can set up a church. Neither can pass laws which aid one religion, aid all religions, or prefer one religion to another. And in the words of Jefferson, the First Amendment clause against establishment of religion by law was intended to erect a wall of separation between church and state. That wall must be kept high and impregnable. We could not approve the slightest breach. I mean, there is no wishy-washiness in his statements about how clear he understands the role of the separation of church and state, and how the Supreme Court must uphold the vision that the founders had in the Constitution.
Yeah, I especially as a science educator, you know, so teaching teachers and seeing the things, you know, like the stuff that goes on in the schools is always it troubles me when I see people trying to attack the Establishment Clause as a way to get like creationism in the classroom or a version of creationism. And then they will use these decisions that have been handed down over the past 50 or so years when it comes to that particular issue to say that, you know, Christians are persecuted in our country, which just always just boggles the mind whenever I see that. It's just unreal to me how that is a narrative right now.
And yet I think those same people would say, if you ask them, yes, we want the separation of church and state, but what they mean is, so long as you're not talking about our church, if we're talking about other religions, we want those out. But because, as the argument goes, America is a Christian nation, we want that in. And so it's really this implicit assumption that separation of church and state really doesn't apply to a lot of the people who say that that's what they want. And so that's really difficult.
Well, when you're in power and you're used to that, equality feels like oppression.
Yeah.
So yeah. I want to affirm to all of my all of the Christian listeners out there who feel that there is a war on Christmas and a war on prayer in schools and that they are being persecuted, that the feeling of being persecuted and about losing is completely real. And the feeling is super valid. And that's still true. It's not actually happening, but the feeling that it is happening. And that feeling then changes policy and public opinion. And so
yeah.
It is as substantive as the thing itself.
Yeah, I always find the war on Christmas conversation to be quite hilarious. That's why I really loved every time around that year when Jon Stewart was in charge of The Daily Show. I loved when he would bring up the war on Christmas stuff because it was just so funny. It was just because people say, happy holidays. Oh my gosh, you hate Christmas. No, I'm just being respectful to others.
Or you're celebrating Advent, Christmas Eve, Christmas Day, and Epiphany. You know, those are the holidays. Those are all the Christian holidays around there. So, and the Feast of St. Stephen. I mean, we've got happy holidays, happy all of them, not just Christmas. I mean,
yeah. It's just, it's always, and I guess it to me, when those conversations come up, about like a war on Christmas, a war on prayer in schools, which is, as you said, it's not accurate. People can still pray in schools. We just can't have state-sponsored prayer, but people can still do it. But to sit there and suggest that, like, it takes away from actual issues because we spend, in my opinion, because yes, there are issues that are there, but I feel like there are so many other things we could be talking about besides, because President Trump was elected, we can now say Merry Christmas. Well, we could say it before, so why is that a big deal? We could already say Merry Christmas. No one was telling us to never say Merry Christmas. There was no state law or federal law that said you may not say Merry Christmas anymore. And so that just statements like that I found just so troubling that, you know, there are actual real issues that we could be resolving in our country besides worrying about if I said Merry Christmas.
So at some point in the past year, my wonderful energetic little son became afraid of bugs. And I don't know who infected my child with these kinds of lies, but now he is afraid of every single bug. And what I don't know what to do with that. And we will be in the car and just driving nicely and then screams bloody murder like he just bit off his tongue. And what's wrong? Are you hurt? Daddy, there's a bug! And he will not calm down until we stop the car and get the bug, or if somebody else, or put down the window and get rid of the bug. And it's never like a hornet or a tarantula or a scorpion or something like that. It's always an ant or a tiny little fly or something that just is so stupid. And I'll say to him, Charlie, it can't hurt you. You don't need to be afraid. Charlie, it cannot hurt you. It's fine here. And I'll even, if we're not driving and we're somewhere else, I'll pick up the bug and I'll show it to him and I'll have him, you know, touch this bug. It's fine. It's great. It's wonderful. It's our friend. And it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter if I'm holding it and if I show him it's not dangerous. To him, it is so dangerous. And it might as well be a tiny tiger. And the fact that it's not dangerous doesn't matter in the practical sense because in his world they are. And so I have to then go into his world in order to interact with him. Telling him over and over and over again that there's no danger doesn't fix anything. And so
it might even do more harm than good.
It might. Yeah. And so I feel that way. And this is me again as a pastor who always has to think practically about interactions. I can't just say, well, you know, there is no persecution of Christians and the whole thing about losing religious liberty, and that's all just stupid and ridiculous, and they need to get over themselves because it's a real feeling and it's a real fear, and it really changes people, and it really impacts the way that they live their lives, and the way that they live their lives impacts the way I live my life and the way we live our life together. And so if it is not real, but it is feels real, what can be done about that? How can we have conversations?
And that's a fair point. Yeah, I think, yeah, I get what you're saying. You know, I don't mean to imply that it is not important of a conversation, and that people, and you're right, people have the feeling that it is real. I guess what my wish would be is if we could then help them understand that it is not accurate. It is, and to take the people who really push that narrative to help them figure out ways to not create so much fear. I feel like it's a overused narrative as a way to instill fear in people. And that's what drives people to make decisions that could harm others.
Wait, do you mean to tell me that someone in a position of power is using fear-based arguments about religion in order to control the populace? Because that has literally never happened before in history.
I know. And I just so wish it there were ways that we could get past that. I mean, fear is a major motivator, and I just, it really is troubling to me that that's what pushes so many people.
Well, it's interesting because if we bring in a theological argument of fear, there was an article, show notes, which a few months ago that talked about which came first, big God or big city. And when you live in a village, you know, it's like Cheers. Everybody knows your name. And if everybody knows your name, everybody knows your business. And if everybody knows your business, if you go steal something, they're going to know it was you because it's obvious who it was. And there's also this desire to take care of one another. And the larger the city grew, the less we knew of each other. And the more trade happened and the more strangers came into our midst, and suddenly we don't know people. So how do we fix that? Having an all-knowing God who will then instill the fear that we humans can no longer instill in one another. And I think that from a theological standpoint has then gone into the political sphere of, okay, well, I don't know you. And so my only understanding of how to get you to listen to me, to get you to trust me, is with fear-based conversation and fear-based directives, right? The old adage, that might be a bit of a stretch, the beatings will continue until morale improves.
Which, isn't that an album? You know,
it's something that...
It's
we
probably
live
a quote from Thomas
that...
Paine.
We live in a fear-based society from many different angles because fear is a motivating factor for people to do things for people that they don't know, you know, which is scary, pun intended. But like Ecclesiastes said, there's nothing new under the sun. So if we want to look at how do we solve this problem, when we can use examples, whether they're good examples or examples of what not to do, what have other cultures done? How have we moved on? So if we go back to where Zach started for us, of the founders of this country decided they didn't like what it was. So they said, let's change it. And so they tried something. And it seems like it works. And in ideal society, it does work with ideal people. We have neither here, neither ideal people nor an ideal society. So how then do we make it work here? And one more tiny little note, when we talk about, you know, political correctness, if that's the term that we so often use for the war on Christmas and, oh, I have to be so politically correct. And I think an answer that we can have is, yes, we are demonstrating compassion.
I like that.
It's not political correctness. It's compassionate speaking. It's compassionate word choice.
There's a wonderful quote from Neil Gaiman that if you just replace political correctness with treating other people with respect, then, and in every time you read that, if you replace that in your head, then you'll be astonished. And he says, and now I know what you're thinking. Isn't that just treating other people with respect gone wild? And so I actually have a Chrome browser extension that anytime on the internet where it says political correctness, my browser changes it to treating other people with respect.
And aww. Really?
It makes news headlines look like they're written by sociopaths.
Like, oh, I like that.
It'll say something like, treating other people with respect is destroying our country. And okay. Yeah.
But I do think this gets to a really sort of critical point about what is it that we're really looking for when we look for the separation of church and state, when we use that language and we sort of invoke it as this sort of American heritage to which it's supposed to be a unifying principle, right? I think it gets to this real issue of saying, what do we really mean when we want to say the prohibition against the free exercise of religion? What does it mean to really inhibit someone's free exercise of religion? I think that's the place where these issues get complicated. And by no means do I want to be an apologist for the, you know, folks who are going to argue that there's a war on Christmas. However, I think there is this legitimate question about how far does that extend? How is it that my choosing to say something is actually restricting the freedom of someone else? You have to be able to see that in order to make that argument about compassion work. And this, because I want to take my dig, is why Thomas Paine is a problem for all of us.
Because for all of us.
For all of us.
Oh, please.
Even those who feel an affinity, right? Because it relies on this notion, right? I think there's a real tension here. Seriously, I think there's a real tension here between the individual who exercises choice and so can choose whatever they want to do, despite what I say about religion in any way, shape, or form, versus the folks who would say, no, those are negotiated concepts that we share and hold together and establish by trust. And so my choices about what constitutes my free exercise of religion are never wholly my own that I do by myself. And I think there's a real fundamental divide there in terms of how you want to conceive that. And that matters. I hope it matters, at least. I keep teaching people about religion, so I'm going to assume it matters.
To defend my boy, you know, he was in Paris during the revolution, the French Revolution, and when they started rounding up religious people and imprisoning people, and people were dying on the streets because they were trying to. During the Reign of Terror, when they were trying to wipe out religious practice, he was in that prison. He was strongly opposed because the free expression of that religion, it was extremely important to him, despite the fact that he didn't have any, and had openly written that he didn't, and that he thought it was ridiculous and nonsensical to be religious. But he still knew that it was important for society for people to be able to, within reason, practice that religion. So basically, you have the right to practice that religion as long as that right doesn't then infringe on somebody else's right to practice their own. And in those places where your rights and their rights clash and there's friction, then we need to work it out often in the courts.
I think that one of the things that is sticking with me is this idea of fear's role in attempting conversations, or in, you know, when Rachel is talking about how as societies grow, we know less and less people in it because it's not just us and a few neighbors living in a small village. But I'm thinking about, like, what do we do? That's the question, the impossible question to answer. And I just want to reference back to what was in the article that we read from The Guardian that I guess Zach shared. I don't know. But this idea of teaching religion in public schools was referenced in that article. And I know other people who support that idea, like people at BU. And I don't remember the name of the person referenced in that article. But my point is, I like the idea of having public schools come up with a curriculum that educates people on religion. And I think that I agree with the idea that it's also very, that will be very difficult and controversial. But I think that I don't feel confident that there is another like consistent, legitimate way for people to understand or learn anything about another religious tradition outside of a school system. And maybe that's a pessimistic way of looking at it, but I just think that if we were able to like find teachers that we could trust to not evangelize like from their particular religious tradition, it would help alleviate so much ignorance about like what those other people are doing in their, you know, houses of worship. And I think that it could be something that helps children become like acclimated to other religious traditions at an earlier age, so that there is actually less fear as you grow into an adult. And I think there's also just the fact that people who live in really homogenous communities will not have the opportunity to always interact with people of other faiths. When I was a kid, I could not tell you what a Jew was. We're like, who are these Jews? I don't know. I never like had any people around my neighborhoods or in, I mean, I'm sure that they were there is the other thing. Like they're there. But the spaces that I walked with my family and growing up in my like K through 12, mostly private school experience, I didn't understand how to articulate what it meant to be a Jewish person. And I remember asking, and maybe I have even shared this before with you all, but I remember asking people around just like, what does it mean to be a Jewish person? I don't know. And I remember even the adults around me who are, you know, you're an adult, you're supposed to know more than me, so that's why I'm coming to you. But they didn't know either, because it was just like not something that was like part of our everyday experience. And I think that's still not an excuse for the way that people use hatred and fear to oppress other like religious groups that aren't your own. But I think that there is something to be said for like active educational efforts to tell people in America that, hey, you Christians, you're not the only ones here. And that's like a massively complicated thing to accomplish through the education system, because there are other problems that we need to deal with too. But I actually just, I think that it's a worthy goal.
Can you teach religion in public schools? Is that taught?
So I don't know is the answer to my question, but I think what I'm referring to is like professors that I know who really care about public education and have like proposed ideas for how that could work. And I'm sure that there are public schools that do it, but it's not widespread in the way that I'm talking about.
And I think, Kendra, to add to what you're saying, I do have that naivete that, well, isn't that the religious institution's job to expose their youth to other organizations? But I do realize that that is maybe more of a religiously liberal and naive view of, say, what confirmation is. I say that because there are many churches which come to our synagogue to expose their, you know, they're sophomores to, oh, this is, before you can confirm in our church and confirm that this is really what you want, you have to see something else. But I do realize that there's...
Now, how does that make you feel?
I love it.
Okay.
I absolutely, 100% love it. And the questions that I get are some of the most treasured because I never would have thought about them. In questions, it gives me the ability to expose people to what Judaism is without the need to say, choose us, or without needing to be defensive. Just a, yeah, I'm so glad you're on this journey. I want you to choose what you're choosing, knowing what else is out there. And for one example, so in most synagogues, and ours is no different, our Torah scrolls are inside an ark, a big wooden box often. And in our particular case, we also have a curtain, right? It feels a little bit like Oz. So we've got this big ark. It opens up and you see a curtain. And these were high school students. And I asked them, what do you think is behind the ark? And the one answer that sticks out is, that's where your baptismal is. I thought, that's such an answer that I never would have even thought about. I never had the ability. I'm like, well, first of all, do you see the depth of this? Not really a place, right? It's only about a foot and a half deep. So that might, physics-wise, probably not an answer.
It's a small dip.
It's just a, yeah. It's
a baptismal
for the sprinkling.
Font.
Exactly. It's for little babies. But that allowed me to go into Jews don't baptize, and what does that even mean? And engage their clergy person with, because different Christian faiths baptize at different ages, and was able to go into that conversation. So I realized that my own experience from that realm is not applied to all religious institutions. But that is a hope of mine, or if not even the religious institution, the parents take their kids. So that notwithstanding, I think one way in the public schools or in the school setting, public or not, is to talk about not religion, but culture and place and ethnicity, and say a piece of this culture, a piece of this ethnicity is their religion, and their religion looks like this. Because I worry that if we talk about religion, we narrow ourselves to maybe either just the Abrahamic faiths, or we say, oh, well, we're going to do it from an ecumenical standpoint, so that we're going to talk just about the differences between Baptists and Protestants and Methodists and Catholics, and forget all of the other religions that actually exist.
Baptists are Protestants. Ugh. Were you even listening to the beginning of this, Rachel?
You know what? Clearly, but there not. Have been so many schisms.
you just lose track.
There's like 30,000 denominations. You're fine.
You know, we always argue over we argue over the color of the carpet and create a new church. I mean, come on.
I asked you the question of how it made you feel, because I was a youth director at a Methodist church in college, and during that confirmation period, the pastor asked me to come along on a little field trip because I was youth director. And we went to a homeless shelter, we went to another place, and then we went to a Hindu temple.
Awesome.
It's a gorgeous place. And all of the wood and all of the idols and everything had come imported directly from India. And it was amazing. It smelled great. It looked great. It was such a wonderful experience. I was taking a class at that point on Asian religion. So I had this all in my head, and I was excited to be able to see some of these things in person, and was really impressed with this pastor that we were going to go, a part of these kids' education on Christianity was to look at other religions and how they practice. And I was really impressed with this guy until we got there. And he just kept on making these snide remarks about these people. And like, one point they were offering a bowl of yogurt in front of an idol, and he said to one of the kids next to him, he's like, they really think he's going to eat that? Oh, come on. What kind of people are these? And he's like, how can they really believe that these are all gods when they made them themselves? I mean, these are ridiculous. And how can they say that there's one divine God, but they have all of these little gods. And I was so taken aback at how disrespectful he was to the people that were letting us into their worship space that I started correcting him in front of the kids.
Good.
Which, he's my boss. I probably could have gotten fired.
Yeah.
I was like, hey, hey, Pastor, you know that whole Trinity thing that we have, Father, Son, Spirit, but one God. Yeah, that's also pretty unfortunate. And, they believe in one single God, Brahma, and the rest are, it's one God with 10,000 faces. That's how they say it. And they even have the Krishna, which is the temporal manifestation of Vishnu that comes into the world to set things right. I mean, that's the same story as Jesus. It's no more or less ridiculous than our own faith. It's just that it's someone else's, and they don't actually believe that that God that they brought in from India is actually the God. Like, that's not the one. That is the physical dwelling place where they ask that God to dwell that inside of that thing. This is not that much different than having a cross in your sanctuary. And just had to keep correcting him in front of these kids. Oh my goodness. Well,
or taking communion.
Yeah, that's a whole nother thing. And I felt bad because it was disrespectful to him in front of these kids that he was teaching, but I couldn't help it because it was so wrong and it was unhelpful. And it was hurtful in many ways. And so when we want to open up education about other religions, for every good, fair teaching of the history and culture of the thing, how many more people are like that uneducated pastor who just sees the differences and wants to mock them and imagines themselves as a modern day Elijah with the prophets of Baal? And
I guess I see that we already have people who are doing this poorly. So I don't know that getting people who do it well will, I mean, I think it will in some ways encourage more people to do it poorly, but I don't think the answer to that for me is to not try to educate people in the way that we all like think it should happen. And I think that it's just part of the process, like most things, that whatever you try to do will be met with opposition, and it's just always going to be messy. And that's unsatisfying because we like there to be simple solutions to these things. But I think I still believe that it's possible to be respectful through curriculum and inform people of the basics. And I also think that the comment you made earlier, Rachel, about maybe we should use the word culture instead of religion in schools, I see where you're coming from, but I also think that that makes it even more complicated, because what does it mean to cut religion along ethnic lines? And then you have, like, there's just like so many more factors that it introduces. And not that we should ignore those things anyway if we're talking about religion over culture, but I think that there is value in using religion as the frame and acknowledging that, like, we can't talk about everything to a bunch of 10th graders. Like, we're going to talk about the main, you know, five religions that are maybe representative of the United States, and acknowledge that there is so much more, but it's impossible to cram all of that into an introductory course for people. And so I think that's also like a common problem in colleges with world religion classes, is that you focus on the main five or six, and people, you know, a lot of people want more, or they're dissatisfied because this one thing is missing. And I think those are really valuable things to acknowledge and to accept as, like, the way that you teach those classes is not the only way to do it. But I just think, I don't know, I think that the efforts to do what I'm talking about, I would never expect to be perfect, but I do think that they could do a lot of good in reducing fear. And I don't really know if that's overly optimistic, but that's just where I'm at right now.
Well, you're here with a group of educators, so education is certainly something that we would advocate for.
Yeah, I mean, I think we're all educators here.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Just to different populaces. And I totally agree. And that line of don't let perfection stand in the way of the good. Right? We need to remember that some progress is better than none, and forward progress is way better than backward progress.
Yep.
So I'm curious also, because I think underlying this sense of how we're all educators, right, is a certain commitment also to a sort of like both, I guess I would call it a holy hospitality, right, and a sort of curiosity, not curiosity, a wonder in the face of a religious tradition that is not my own. Somehow that's not threatening, right, to us. And I think that's an important piece of what undergirds the way that we're talking about what positive religious education might look like. And I am willing to bet, and also I'm curious to hear where that can you all think of a moment where that happened for you, where suddenly other religious traditions weren't threatening, this was inviting. And as is so often the case, I have killed whatever forward momentum we had. It's good.
Well,
so Adam, in usual form, you asked a really great question and asked for an illustration. So I'm going to push back and say,
No, you're not allowed. No. You're not allowed to just push this immediately back to me. I asked the question.
Hey, you can only do that to your students.
And in typical Zach fashion, I'm going to also say that we are at the end of this episode.
We're at our time.
Adam always asks great questions at the very end of an episode. But as I said before, we're not going to be modeling the Hardcore History Podcast, and we're not going to be releasing six-hour episodes. We're going to try to keep them at or below or a little bit above about an hour. So we are at that point now, and we have barely scratched the surface of this conversation. And so I think it would be helpful next week if we can first start off by sharing a story about that time when we first had that, I call it holy envy, when we realized that there is something good and beautiful in another person's religious beliefs and not to be feared. And then we will also start going into some of the more specifics of the establishment clause. We dipped our feet in a little bit with Everson versus Board of Education, but there's a couple of other cases, some that are happening right now, right? We would be remiss in having a conversation about church and state if we didn't talk about the cake. And it's not a portal reference. I mean, literally, the cake for the same-sex couple and the cases that have gone on since then, and what that unfolds. And there's a whole lot in that I don't want to talk about right now, but I want to tease that out, and I want to whet your appetite if you're listening at home, that we will be back next week with some really juicy bits. And as we further go down this dangerous wormhole, just to also tease that we'll be talking about the Satanic Temple at one point. And we have an interview set up already with a Native Hawaiian pastor. We're going to be talking a lot about Native communities and the U.S. government and the religious liberties of Indigenous peoples. And we've just got a whole lot coming down the pipe, and super excited about this series. So stay tuned. This has been episode 9 of the Down the Wormhole podcast. Thank you so much for taking the time to go on this journey with us. If you like what you hear, do us a favor, leave a review on iTunes and follow us on social media. It might not seem important, but it does help more people find the show. Check us out at downthewormhole.com for copious show notes and links to all our social media accounts. Make sure you join us next week as we get into the nitty-gritty of religion, political science, holy envy, and holy hospitality. We will also discuss how dangerous it is to cherry-pick bits and pieces from the Bible and the Constitution to prove your point. And so with that, I will sign off by doing that very thing.
Thomas Paine is a problem for all of us.
That's blasphemy right there.
Get out.
Just stop talking.
Get out.